Hello everyone, I'm here with John Ferguson and we're right in the middle of a five-day program, evangelism program, healing, revival here in Fiji, and just been talking with John about different issues related to evangelism, and I'm just going to ask him questions and we're going to discuss this for the sake of becoming more effective in ministry. And what's it like when you're organizing these massive crusades when you were working for Reinhard Bonnke and he's a famous person? Are you just getting flooded with invitations all over the world? How do you plan this kind of stuff?
Yeah, Bonnke was getting invitations every day from different cities, different countries who wanted him to come and do crusades. And when I was working for him, which was in the 90s, he had decided that he would do between one and two crusades every year outside of Africa, because the majority of his work in those days was in Africa. And so the question was, how did we decide where to go? And mostly, of course, he would, when he got invitations, he would pray about them. And then one of my roles, I was the International Crusade Director, and one of my roles was to actually go and check out different places and see if they were suitable for a crusade. And there were a number of issues that we would look for. But the first and most important issue was the Spirit of God already at work in that place or in that city? And one of the main ways we would check that is to see if the pastors were meeting together and there was unity in the churches. And that was usually evident by the fact that the churches were holding combined prayer meetings. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited about the combined prayer meetings that we're beginning in Auckland right now, so which are starting next week. That's very exciting. So we would look for that. So we would look for pastors' unity. I remember going to one city, for example, in India, and when I got there, I discovered that there were actually seven different pastors' groups, and none of them would talk to each other. And one of the pastors specifically said, if you're talking to that pastor, I'm not going to be involved. So when you meet that kind of disunity, and I just said to Reinhard, it's a waste of time to go there. So that was the spiritual side of it. Then there's the sheer practicality of organizing big meetings. Reinhard always preferred to use open ground, open air, rather than stadiums. Stadiums, in those days, it's a bit easier now with good sound, but in those days, stadiums were notoriously difficult to hold crusades in. And we did a number of crusades in stadiums, but it was difficult. One of the main reasons was the issue of crowd control. Most stadiums are designed so that the crowd can't get from the stands down onto the pitch, and when you're making an altar call or when you want people to come and testify, that was just a nightmare. So in the simpler stadiums it was possible to organize, but the more sophisticated ones, very difficult. The other major problem was sound, because you've got with big speakers, it bounces off the stadium, the sound bounces all around the place and you just echo everywhere and they can't hear. So, and then of course there was the cost. Stadiums were always very, very expensive. So we always preferred to be in the open air with sound towers. So we would look for a place, you know, big enough piece of ground which had to be accessible and had to be, you know, on good bus routes with opportunity for car parking or whatever the form of transport was that the locals were using. So those were practical issues that we were looking for. And if all of that was in place, then we would know we could do a crusade there. So I went to investigate cities like Hong Kong, where it was clear that it wasn't going to work. Just for practical reasons, but also spiritual reasons, because the churches in those days were not charismatic, and so that presented a problem. And then in other places like Jamaica, where Reinhard actually initially didn't want to go, but when we got there we discovered that the place was wide open and the people were hungry for us, and we did a good crusade there in Kingston. So yeah, I investigated lots of cities.
What were some of the other countries that you did do crusades?
We personally did crusades in Indonesia. We did two. I did a crusade in Buenos Aires in Argentina. We did two crusades in Brazil, and Bonky's been back to Brazil since then. And then we did one in Trinidad, one in Jamaica, and then we went to India, and we did seven or eight crusades in India as well. Cities like Bangalore, Madurai, Chennai, Pune. We did one up in northeast in Shillong. Yeah, and then we went down to Sri Lanka and Colombo. We did one there. That was amazing because it was during the Civil War, there was just a short window of a few months when there was a ceasefire, and those few months we managed to go in and do this big crusade in Colombo and then come out again, and then they all started fighting again. So it was just a God-given window.
Awesome.
Yeah. Mm.
You were mentioning to me that to begin with it seems like you would go there longer, but then you realised that wasn't working as well as this, just going to a place short term to organise. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, what happened was we were organising, we were sent to the city, like Buenos Aires. We lived in Buenos Aires for a year, and we would go there and we would find an apartment to live in. We would have to open offices, we'd have to buy a car, and appoint secretaries and things, and so it was a fairly major financial commitment, and took a lot of organizing and a lot of cooperation. But the main issue that we discovered by accident really was that when you were there, it was much harder for the local pastors to own the event. Because when you're around, they expect you to do everything. And so, I mean, that was fine. I was willing to do it. But actually, it meant that they were willing to pass everything off to us to do. And instead of, in that way, they didn't really own it. Then when we were working in Brazil, we were invited to go and do a crusade in Trinidad. And that was going to happen simultaneously, and I had to organize them at the same time, so it was impossible to be in both places at once. So I would just fly up to Trinidad for a week or so and spend the time with the local pastors and share the vision and explain how it works, and then come back again. And actually that was much cheaper for us to organize it that way, and more effective, because the local pastors bought into the vision much more readily. So then from there on in, we were living in the UK in those days, and so we went back and moved back into our house in the UK, and instead of living on the site, I travelled backwards and forwards to India for about 3 or 4 years. I was going 6 or 7, maybe 8 times a year to India, to different cities, setting up the crusades. And in fact, we could set up 2 or 3 crusades at once, because I would go to one city doing investigation work, so that might be a year or 18 months ahead of time, but another city where we'd already got a committee going, and you'd go there and be working with the committee, and then you'd keep going back to perhaps a third city where the crusade was just about to happen and Bonky was about to move in, and the team arrive, and it all happens.
What about the stress levels? Was any of that going on?
Yeah, stress levels were high. And in fact, we did this for 7 years, and after that I was done, I was exhausted. In a sense, I would have liked to have gone on working, and we would have, if we'd taken some time out, we could have gone back to it. But yeah, the stress levels were very high. And anyway, God called us out. I mean, the Lord spoke to me, said it was time to leave, and so we obeyed the voice of God, and He's blessed our time since. But yeah, there were lots of high stress moments. One of the greatest moments I remember was in Jamaica, when I got a phone call from one of the local pastors, the organizing pastors, saying, I hear this crusade has been cancelled. And this was news to me. I knew nothing about that. So I contacted the office in Germany, and they said, yeah, we've had to cancel the crusade because we ran out of money. And I didn't believe that was possible, because we'd never cancelled the crusade because we'd run out of money. And so I just said, this is the work of the enemy and we have to pray about it. So anyway, the team, amazing, the CFAN team, had a whip round, and we all contributed and managed to come up with enough money to fund the crusade. But for about 48 hours, that was fairly nail-biting. You know, we'd invested huge amount of time and effort and money, resources, into organizing this thing, and then it looked as though it was going to be pulled. And then one crusade was actually cancelled that we were involved with, but not by us. This was in Surabaya in Indonesia, and we'd been working there for 6 months. When we literally, Reinhardt was there. There were 20,000 people in the stadium, and when I went to pick up Reinhardt and take him to the crusade to preach, when I got there, he was just dressed in jeans, and I said, "What's happened?" And Peter Vandenberg was there, and he said, "Crusade has been cancelled. The security have just pulled the plug on it," which was a bit of a shock. Whether the government had submitted to pressure, or whether they'd always actually planned to do that, I don't know. Or maybe even they just, there was some security threat that they were not prepared to risk. But obviously that was heartbreaking. We'd invested a lot in that. It was a little bit like, the way I felt at the time was that we'd had a stillbirth. You know, you've gone to all of that, the pregnancy, and then the child's dead, and that's how we felt. But Bonnke went back there some years later after we'd left, and they'd had another successful event there. Exciting what God is doing in Indonesia, actually. So the latest figures suggest it's about 40% Christian now. So one of the most Christian nations on earth, even though it's supposed to be a Muslim nation.
It's amazing when you just think of the awesome scale of Bonnke's ministry. Any idea how God was able to just entrust?
I find it just extraordinary that I was just a farmer and I knew absolutely nothing. And by God's grace, the first crusade we did was in Jakarta in Indonesia. And we were teamed up with a group of Chinese businessmen, lovely Christians, very organized. I mean, one of them owned a bank, so it gives you the sort of idea of the scale of the type of people we were working with. And they loved the Lord, and they were very organized, and they knew how to do crusades. And the most important thing in that kind of environment, they knew the right people. In those kind of countries, you don't get permits without knowing the right people. Or through just prayer. I mean, and they know how to pray as well. So I learned a lot from them, and I learned a lot in Buenos Aires. We had a group, we were working with a team who had organized a crusade for Billy Graham the year before that we got there. So, you know, a lot of the infrastructure was in place, and they knew what they were doing. So, but how? The main approach that we had to organizing was the first thing that we would do is actually go and visit the key leaders. And sometimes we wouldn't have no idea who they were, but we would go and find one and say, can I come and speak to you? And Reinhardt's name was well known, so it was not difficult for me to get interviews with some of the key leaders. And so you'd go to one key leader and then say, would you be interested in Bonnke coming? And they'd say yes. And then I'd say, and who are the other key leaders? And they would give you the names. And you'd just go and knock on their doors and talk to them. And then having got the main key leaders on board of the main denominations and the main churches, the next thing was to establish a working committee. And it was quite important that the working committee did not consist of the main leaders, because the main leaders, denomination heads of the leaders of big churches, haven't got time. And we made this mistake several times, that actually if they wanted to be the chairman, the chairman of a crusade basically has to give up a whole year of his time and do nothing else, because it is so all-consuming. And if a pastor wants to take that on, it doesn't work. So what I tried to do was to encourage the pastors to appoint the committee that they would trust, but men that they knew could make things happen, men and women too, that could make things happen, and people who had influence, but most importantly, people who had time. And often it worked best if they were businessmen. And in fact, one of the best crusades in terms of organizing was the one, funnily enough, in Surabaya, which didn't come off. But in terms of organizing, the guy who was running that was a Chinese businessman. Man, he was good. He was just a natural organizer, and everybody loved him, and everybody wanted to work for him. And he would just appoint people and say, well, you can do this and you can do that. And everybody was, yeah, that's what I want to do. And it worked. Other times it didn't work as easy as that. Yeah, we had some interesting times.
What would you say to the countries that kind of feel like crusades don't work now? That may have been something in the past, or it works in Africa, but it won't work here. Kind of attitude that...
Crusades have their place without question, and you can meet dozens of Christians who have got saved in crusades. People level at crusades the fact that, you know, they may only have 5 or 10% retention rate. Reinhardt was very, very keen to increase that, and we spent a lot of time designing good follow-up. Something that God told Reinhardt to do many, many years ago was to produce a booklet which he called Now That You Are Saved, which was actually a biblical, well, it was kind of a sermon in a booklet form, on the assurance of salvation. That is, how can we know that the decision we've made is a genuine one? And so he designed that booklet to be given to new believers. And the other key part of it was, it had a decision card in either duplicate or triplicate glued into the back, so that the person has a physical record of the decision that they have made, and the cards can be torn off and given to the local pastors. And it also gave Reinhardt accurate record of the number of people who were making decisions in each meeting, and that's how they know, for example, now the latest figures are that in Reinhardt's ministry, over 75 million people have made decisions. That's actually recorded on paper. That's not just hands that go in the air. So he gives the booklets away. As he said one day, we're trying to save souls, not books. And so he likes to give the books away. But I got quite involved in the process of how we deal with the decision cards. Because we discovered that a number of churches, the decision cards would sit on the pastor's desk. And he wouldn't do anything about them because he was too busy. And unfortunately, those new believers would not, if they didn't get followed up, they wouldn't go into the churches. They wouldn't go on with the Lord. And that was very, very sad. Other churches worked much more intensively in the follow-up. And in those cases, the people would join in the churches. In fact, I just quote a couple of examples that we did the research on. There was one city where we did the research afterwards, and we found one church had not done any follow-up, and only 3 out of 300 actually joined his church. Another church actively did the follow-up of the new believers, and 400 out of 700 joined his church. And so therefore, for me, proactive follow-up is very, very important. So there were three elements of it, really. One was giving a free booklet at the crusade, which gives the new believer something to take home, a record of the decision that they've made, which we feel is important. The second thing was a decision card, which can be passed to the right person to be able to follow up. And in fact, one of the things we did to encourage the pastors, for example, we liked to train the follow-up team. And we gave the new believers, sorry, we gave the decision cards of the new believers to the pastors in proportion to the number of trained people they had in their churches. So if the pastors were willing to train their whole church, they got more decision cards than the pastor who was fairly casual and only trained half a dozen. And it didn't matter whether how big the church was. What we were concerned was about how many people have put themselves forward to be willing to go and do the proactive follow-up. And
that's a great point.
That worked very well as a system. Very often some of the smaller churches are full-on enthusiastic, and they've got the motivation to look after the new believers, whereas some of the bigger churches are kind of a bit more casual about it. And I mean, it might be the other way around. I'm not saying anything against bigger churches, but it's just that was the way we organized it. And another thing we found was it depended very much on the size of the city. In a big city, it was important to divide the decision cards up regionally, because people are not going to travel across the city. I mean, even just thinking of Auckland, which isn't that big compared with some of the places we worked, somebody living in the south isn't going to be encouraged to go all the way to West Auckland to a church. They want a church in South Auckland. So it'd be important to actually divide the church regionally, establish how far people are willing to travel. Another interesting thing was that the people attending a smaller church will want it to be in a local area. People attending a big church are willing to travel further. And again, so for example, using the example of Auckland, if people are attending Life, they'll travel across the city. But if people are attending their little local church, then they want to walk there. So that we had to bear that in mind when we were distributing the decision cards as well, and we developed a system where we could accommodate most of those things. But the main key was encouraging the pastors to motivate their people to be proactive in follow-up. And what we found was, if it's possible, wherever it's possible, the person who's made a decision one day needs a phone call the next day. They need somebody to say, "Hey, you made a decision yesterday, and we're really excited by that, and we're here to help you," and da-bi-da, you know that. And try to make contact. We always encourage personal contact. And as long as the the individual. It can't be down to the pastor. The pastor has to be willing to delegate that responsibility to his people, and that's the way it should be anyway. We should be all active in that process. All of us know that discipleship, you know, we needed somebody to hold our hand through those first few weeks and months, even years, depending on how many issues we have. We need someone to hold our hand, and that's absolutely critical. And I see churches that train their people to be proactive in discipling are going to be much more effective in retaining the fruit of these big events. Reinhard, in the days when we were working, well, I don't know what his figures are now, but when we were working for him, he was seeing 25% of the new believers ending up established in the church. So I think compared with some other big meetings, I think those figures are very, very good. We were impressed with them, but obviously we would like to go see that better. Remember, of course, another thing that I haven't mentioned, and that is that an awful lot of the new believers or the responders are actually already churchgoers, and they come along to the crusade and they realize perhaps they've never committed their life to the Lord, made a decision to follow Christ, and then they need to be followed up, but they need to be followed up in their own church, because one thing that the pastors are always afraid of or worried about is, if I get involved in this event, will my people be invited to go to another church? We were very clear, no. On the decision card would always be the question, do you already attend a church? If so, which church? And then if that church name was down on the decision card, that decision card automatically went to that church, regardless of anything else, so that that church knew that member had made a decision, and they would be responsible for following their own people. So that was another important aspect that we did.
How would you deal if the person was going to a church you knew that was a cult? Or
yeah, that's a good question. We only gave decision cards to registered churches. We registered all the churches for the crusade. So we would not give decision cards to churches that were not registered. Now that actually did two things. First of all, it encouraged the churches in the area or in the city to register, because they knew that if they didn't register, they didn't get decision cards. But the other thing that happened automatically was that the cults actually self-excluded themselves. They did not sign up, which meant that if they were not evangelical, if they didn't believe the gospel, they didn't want to be part of an event where the gospel was being preached.
Did Roman Catholics at all ever want to be a part of it?
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting one. It depended very much on which nation we were working in. In South America, for example, I think it was fair to say the Roman Catholics at that time were the enemy. They were actively against evangelism and actively against what the locals called the Evangelical Church, which included the Pentecostal churches. And the Evangelical Church in those days was everybody who wasn't Catholic. That was in their understanding. However, when we got to Jamaica, for example, the Catholic bishop was one of the key committee members, and he was spirit-filled. He was born again and filled with the Holy Spirit. He loved Jesus. He was a mighty man of God, and the Catholics were fully on board. So it depended very much on the leaders and where they stood in terms of their relationship with the Lord. That naturally sorted itself out. We would go and visit the leaders and see what their response was. But if they didn't love Jesus, they, to be honest, they wouldn't bother to register. And so then when we gave the decision cards to the other churches, and if anybody grumbled, we would just say, well, you know, you had the opportunity to register, but you didn't register. So we made that clear to everybody, and we never had any issues with that. So there was never an issue about the cults, or the, I mean, they might fight against it, but yeah, it wasn't an issue of having to give decision cards to a dead church.
So if there's a person who's God's stirring their heart to enter into this kind of work of organizing large-scale crusades, what advice would you to prepare them for what they're going to actually face?
Like anything else in Christian ministry, don't do it unless you're called. You have to be called. It's like anything else. You know, whether you're going to be a pastor or a prophet, or it's not just something you can do because it's a good job. No, you've got to be called. And by God's grace, we were. And then God enables you to do. It's just as impossible doing something like this as it is healing the sick. You just have to know God's called you to do it and then get out and do it. Like anything else for the Lord, it's hard. But very rewarding. Most of all, you know, when you've put 6 months or a year effort into organizing this big meeting, and then suddenly you see 50, 60, 70,000 people getting saved. Very, very, very rewarding.